Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves podcast. You know, the subject of health is such a hot topic. It always has been, but it's especially become a hot topic because it became associated with politics. So, you know, if you're American or not, we're all getting more familiar with the Make America Healthy Again movement, MAHA. And there's a lot of different feelings on it, which I totally understand. There's a lot of complexity to it. One thing that I do actually really like about this movement is the exploration of the safety of vaccination and also what is informed consent. You know, I was largely outspoken during COVID for many reasons, but mainly because during that time, there was the use of relationship and belonging as a mechanism of behavioral change. And all of us suffer that, right? Like all of us suffer when marketing or public health or politics or all these things leverage belonging and shame as a behavioral modification strategy. This would be thought to be similar in politics to using things like a wedge issue, that when you use a wedge issue, people are left more divided, even though you might get elected. And so really exploring that, you know, I'm Martin Kulldorff, who is a former professor at Harvard. He was talking about how the safety of vaccination is actually a pro-vaccination conversation, but yet it's somehow been turned into anti. So that to me just shows that there's a lot of emotion and also marketing behind the idea of not being curious. Now, I get the conversation that criticizing vaccines might cause vaccine adoption to go down. And so in doing that, it's actually not a safe conversation to have. But I would say that we're at a precipice where the trust in public health and vaccination, it could only help it to provide more evidence, right? So not talking about it just fuels the conspiracies, but at least exploring it and getting more clear data is important. Today's episode, I interview Dr. Taylor Bean, who is a naturopathic doctor, and she is considered a foremost expert in vaccine education and informed consent across all categories of medicine, so not just naturopathic. And she, in this episode, we talk about how do you actually achieve and what is informed consent and what is the challenges behind that. And, you know, she actually vaccinates in her practice, so clearly not an anti-vaxxer. And so this conversation, I think, is one that's so important as the dialogue about this gets greater, but also we have to learn how to be able to hold this conversation with grace and navigate the complexity that everyone's emotional response to it is valid, but also your resistance or apprehension is valid. And so how do we actually enter discussions and have open dialogue, access critical thinking, which is impossible to do when we're triggered, and, you know, really focusing on health autonomy of an individual, a family, and wanting you through this conversation, as well as I, to build more education for ourselves so that we can be informed and active in the choices we make about our own health. So without further ado, here's Dr. Taylor Bean. Hello and welcome to another episode. I've got Dr. Taylor Bean here. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
So happy to have you on. We tried once, but we had some audio issues. And so we are back. And times have shifted a bit since the last time you and I spoke. Mm-hmm. It seems like a very quickly moving landscape in the space of health. Is that fair to say?
Yes. No, I would totally concur with that in aspects throughout the country, even through the province that I'm in, British Columbia. All licensed healthcare practitioners, our colleges have now amalgamated. So last time that we chatted, that was pen to paper, but it hadn't been signed off quite yet. So there are now only six colleges. I believe it's only six colleges in British Columbia. And as a naturopathic doctor, we've amalgamated with chiros, RMTs, and your TCM acupuncturist. So we didn't really know what that landscape looks like. Is it for the better? Is it, you know, for our scope of practice? How's that going to change? We're still some moving parts with that. So that has changed, which is pretty big within for us as licensed healthcare practitioners. what that looks like.
Yeah, because in, and just for you listening, Dr. Taylor Bean is a naturopathic doctor. She's got a special expertise in a lot of things, but really is a master at informed consent and explaining what that is. And it seems to me like once people actually learn what informed consent is, they might recognize that their right to it has been violated actually pretty substantially. Is that just a right-wing tinfoil hat thought?
Or? No, you know, informed consent is, you know, having the opportunity to ask questions is a big component of achieving informed consent. And I think in different areas, there are gray zones to what informed consent means or its interpretation. And I think as a practitioner, you can blur the lines of what informed consent means for you as a practitioner, what you think is enough to tell a patient so they can consent to that, and or a parent is consenting for their child. It seems some areas of medicine are going to be more than others. To me, means informed consent is informed consent, no matter what the subject is within medicine. And for those that don't know, vaccination is a large part of my practice and has been for over a decade. And true informed consent to me, in terms of vaccination, I might spend 1 to 2 to 3 hours with patients over time, really, for them, because they have so many questions. Right. And as a parent, you should always have the opportunity to ask those questions, and those questions should be answered to their full capacity in terms of you to finally achieve what you need to know to be informed. And I think with vaccinations, it's actually a huge subject to achieve that, you know, but really what happens is the informed consent is, do I have your consent to administer this into your arm and breach your dermal layer and inject you with a needle? That's where the informed consent is. Can I touch you to then inject this? Not what's behind the needle and having discussion about that. And it's almost as though you understand inherently what this vaccine is going to do for you and why you're doing it, and we'll make an assumption. And that's when it also comes to, here we have what's called the Infant Act and children consenting to something like a vaccine that are even 12 and under. And the person that's administrating the vaccine, it is up to their discretion if the child understands what they're talking about. And if they think, okay, this child understands what I'm talking about, I've achieved their informed consent, I will then administer this vaccine. And so grade 6 in British Columbia and most provinces is where you have the HPV vaccine, the Hep B vaccine, chickenpox vaccine. And be it, does a child truly understand what HPV is, or to the public health, the risk of the infection of the vaccine. But a 12-year-old is not going to know what to ask nor understand anything about infections or immunology. But to the public health side, is they don't need to know that. We don't need to go there. It is, we have this tool to help protect you, and can I simply administer it into your arm? That's all I need. That's the informed consent. So
it's wild to me that that has become the bar. Like, that's the bar. And, you know, I think because there's been so much cultural shaping around the conversation of, as you're discussing, vaccines, that to ask questions is to not trust, and then you get put in this tinfoil hat, anti-vax mom camp, for example, in the conversation about kids. And so even the healthcare provider kind of looks at you like, oh, you're one of those. And so I've always said this because I was never actually curious about childhood vaccines because I didn't have a kid yet. And my wife was like, nah. And I was like, we'll talk about it when we get there. Like, it's not even worth going there right now.
Right.
You know, I was like, I've been successfully in a relationship with her for long enough to know it's not the hill we're dying on today.
Right. Yeah.
But actually, when I dove deep into the research on the COVID vaccine, that's when I was like, well, there's a lot of BS here. There's been a lot of misrepresentation, a lot of marketing that's masquerading as public health information. And so I started to dive deeper into childhood vaccinations and the flu vaccine. And it was actually very similar, which now I just expect this, but it's very similar to what my experience was when I studied cholesterol and cardiovascular disease, that I was like, wait, statins? Oh my God, what a farce. A lot, you know, and then looking at the story of what creates and causes heart disease and how insulin resistance was really left out of that conversation. It was all about just getting your LDL down, and you can use seed oils for that. Like the whole sort of, it's like the whole band is playing in terms of corruption, and they're all like, this is amazing. Money's raining on agriculture, on big food, and on big pharma. And now I actually was listening to a doctor the other day talking about how Ozempic has now come into this conversation. We don't have to go down that avenue, but we can. But that in the 70s and 80s, GLP-1 agonists, right, like sucralose and high fructose corn syrup, were released into the food. And now we have a drug that perfectly treats that receptor. I say all this because in that conversation about this child purporting to give consent, is also the lack of data and conversation that, if I understand correctly, and you can tell me from what I've read, first off, there's a lot of lawsuits about the HPV vaccine. And there's also a conversation how these children in later in life actually have higher incidence, I want to say, of shingles. Is that correct?
From the chickenpox vaccine, I would say the HPV.
The chickenpox vaccine.
Yeah.
And that the HPV vaccine, does it actually reduce the cancer, because it's supposed to target the three strains?
So there's more than 50. There's nine, SCARSL 9. Okay, and there was four main ones, four.
Okay. So I was and off by one.
You're bang on.
Close.
And so there was four. And then so now we have the GARDASIL 9. But what's interesting is that for GARDASIL vaccine is very effective. It's very effective. In terms of having the body make antibodies toward those specific strains. The question is now, is all the other strains, because in terms of cervical cancer, which is mainly its point.
Yeah, that's the whole, that's its marketing
message.
We will prevent it.
Prevent. And other cancers has been throat cancers that have come with HPV prevention. Yeah. But the main is cervical cancer. Of course, with cervical cancer, it's very, very slow growing. And preventative would be for women to do pap smears and to see if there's changes and if we're identifying there's HPV. So the four, so there's with now nine, which there's over, what's the number? Over 50 different HPV strains. The question is making immunity to the nine, are we allowing the other strains, which were not originally a problem, are now becoming a problem? Because you basically make memory to these main nine ones,
set them
aside, but then now we have these other strains that are coming forward. And cervical cancer is slow growing, but will cervical cancer now not be slow growing and be more invasive as a result of moving aside these known strains, but sort of a vacuum effect comes in to allow these other strains to potentially become an issue, which we are not going to know, but until over time, to see, okay, well, cervical cancer is on the rise, which specific strains it's causing, none that are in a vaccine. So these are all these questions that coming out of it.
Cervical cancer is on the rise now.
I wouldn't say it's on the rise, but I wouldn't say it's trending down.
It's not gone.
It's not gone.
Which
and
is
it hasn't
a promise.
Right. It hasn't, the HPV vaccine unfortunately hasn't made significant strides in cervical cancer. And so what I would like to see and haven't read yet is cervical cancers today, which someone I'm sure knows, is it still from the main four strains, or is cervical cancer from other strains that which the vaccine doesn't cover? Because the Gardasil has gone from its jump from four to nine. So now we're covering other strains, and are we going to continue? We have to continue with that trend. I mean, go to the chickenpox vaccine, for example, which is varicella. Some people say varicella, but varicella is a herpes virus. So it's part of the herpes family, and which many folks will remember having chickenpox. And so then you create immunity
people
to
had
that.
Chickenpox parties together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I didn't have a chickenpox party, but that was a thing for me for sure. It used to be, in terms of measles, had measles parties too. Right. Same idea. Now with chickenpox, it's not lifelong memory, but solid 20 to 30 years from naturally acquired. What nature intended with chickenpox is that as a parent, you would be re-inoculated by your child. And then grandparent would also receive a step up of their memory by being
they'd
around
have
it
T-cell
again.
Memory that then would be reactivated, and they'd be able from that memory to build an immune response relatively quickly to a new strain.
And so with the chickenpox vaccine, what's interesting is that shingles has increased, and shingles is reactivation of varicella, and so you get it as chickenpox, and then it's going to lay dormant in your spinal cord. And then if it's reactivated, it comes out as this band on your body called shingles. It's following what's called a dermatome, and it hurts. So, but now there's shingles vaccine. The shingles vaccine is now there because shingles is increased, and be it because as adults, we're not getting re-inoculated by our children. What's interesting is the UK, they have it available, the chickenpox vaccine, but it's not part of their childhood schedule. It's not part of the schedule. It's there. Chickenpox parties are still fine to do. You're not going to be shamed by having a chickenpox party in the UK, because it's still, they didn't put it on the schedule because they hypothesized that shingles would increase if they put it on the childhood schedule.
It's almost like infectious disease experts were making a choice based evidence, not marketing and propaganda. I have so much cynicism about this now, because I'm just like, we keep taking a left where evidence is taking a right, because so many of the decisions are emotionally and politically based. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think of the informed consent in the context of the COVID vaccine. If you were administering it early on, which how could you ever give proper informed consent? First off, the media was in charge of informing everybody. And so they all took that role, which meant they did not, and still do not for the most part, but did not ever talk about adverse reactions. And what's interesting is that if you were truly giving informed consent, and you could tell me what it might have looked like even more so, but the first thing they should have said is, this is an experimental product. It has not received official Healthcare Canada approval. Mm-hmm. It's an emergency use. Mm-hmm. We do not know the long-term effects of this. We actually also don't know that it reduces transmission, but that is the hope. Do you feel okay taking this given just those few things?
Right.
Now, of course, most people would go, that's a little bit freaky. And they also would have said, we don't know that this will provide herd immunity because it's, from what we know, not a sterilizing vaccine. Those are the complete opposite of the actual message that was sent. And when those of us who went, just want to point out, were villainized, ostracized because of so much of the brilliant industrial strength propaganda campaign that was created that turned the majority of people, but I'll say Canadians in this context, into little pharmaceutical reps who were objection handlers. And everyone was so afraid that they were themselves bypassing their right to informed consent because they were fearing being seen as not doing it together. All the language that inferred belonging and morality. And if you in any way didn't agree with any of that or had a question that was different, you were instantly vilified. And I mean, who wanted to be called by all their friends, which happened to me, an anti-vaxxer, which I never was. Mm-hmm. Now I'm proudly. And now I'm like, look, I could see value in some of them for some things, and I'm open to having that conversation. But I am proudly now recognizing that they didn't tell people that SV40, which is a cancer-promoting monkey cell,
polio vaccine,
SV40 was in it. Fragments of DNA that are way beyond the upper limit of allowable that can cause integration into cells. None of that was shared, and Health Canada knew it.
Right.
And to me, I'm like, and that can cause the proliferation of cancers. To me, there's just a lot of sadness I have for all the ways that people should be angry, but instead we're going 4 years, we'll just move on.
Yeah.
And I'm going, no, like each individual Canadian who chose to do this because they were mandated and shamed had their right to informed consent violated, in my opinion, and actually is entitled to back pay, is entitled to some sort of compensation for the fact that they took a product that they were not fully informed about. I mean, am I taking crazy pills?
So what you said earlier in terms of explaining to someone what the vaccine was and they didn't know is what you do in clinical trials. And COVID vaccine is phase 3 clinical trial when it was available to everyone. And that's what you state for phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials in vaccines or any phase. In terms of vaccinations, you go through phase 1, animals, phase 2, humans, and same thing with phase 3. Phase 3 is just more humans. And then it is licensed and put on the market, and then it's available to the public. And now we're into phase 4, which, if anything happens, is to be reported. And it's post-surveillance reporting is what you're supposed to be doing. But with COVID vaccine, is we skipped a kind of a major step and everyone entered phase 3 is what happened. And if you're in a clinical trial, then you should be providing that information to someone to choose to be in it or not. But because it was an emergency order, everyone was allowed to have access to it without the completion of phase 3 because it was happening so quickly and wanting to get out because it was the only tool that the conventional allopathic side had in terms of being reducing reactions to COVID itself was a vaccine, and to protect people is the only thing that they had. There's other things you could use alongside that tool, but that's the only thing that they pushed, and it turned into sort of a warfare between whom would do it and who wouldn't. And let's use shame and gaslighting as a tool to get people to do it. Incentives. Let's pay you. Let's give you something in order to do it.
That's a complete violation of informed consent.
Yes, completely. So, and this is part, I mean, I've been in vaccine discussions with parents way before COVID. And this is part of the why, because I don't stand for mandates, particularly in Canada. I lived in a country with mandates, but that was part of the country in Singapore that I lived in. They had mandates only for 2 vaccines, not all of them, but 2 of them. And that's just how it was. So it's not that I wasn't against it or had anything to do with that decision-making whatsoever. It was just, that's how it was. And so we worked with that, but I wasn't ever going to use the tactic of manipulation to get someone to do something. And I see that. I mean, see it in other areas of medicine in terms of manipulation, and particularly in labor. And that's where my informed consent literally was born out of, is my experience with birthing my first son, which was an exceptionally amazing experience for me. But I could see how it could not be. I mean, I come with some, not experience, but training in terms of naturopathic medicine in obstetrics of what my decisions can be in terms of how I'm going to position and birth my baby. If I want to be on my knees or my back or standing upside down, I can do whatever I want. You, as the provider, should be able to catch that baby. And so I learned that in my training. And so although my obstetrician was amazing in Singapore, I had a home birth, which is sort of against the norm in Singapore. I had a water birth, I had a doula, and it was just exceptional. But and he was a little bit passive, so didn't push. He would question, but he wouldn't push. But I could see how it could have gone had I not known what I knew and what I stood for and my birth plan, which he followed through with all of that. But I could see how it could go the opposite. And to me, it was really a awakening call, because labor is, that time is such a very intimate, I think, imprinting time on your child, and it could never take back. And I wanted it to be as, you know, calm and peaceful and for me and for my son. And it was. And so I knew what I wanted, and it happened. But to me was, do even women know this? Does anyone ever offer this to them? Do they even have any idea that you can birth on your knees? Like, do
that it's helpful.
That's helpful that you can have gravity help you when you're
like
birthing.
The toilet, I remember being the shower, the bathtub,
like being in water. I mean, my obstetrician did know these things, and he said to me one of a natural analgesic is going to be in water, and then he suggested hypnobirthing. So it was pretty amazing for an obstetrician to suggest that, but he already knew of it, and lots of mamas that's why he was chosen. And so I was like, I didn't know that. I didn't have no birthing. Oh my goodness, what is that? And sure, water. Yes, totally. I'll do that. And so he was part of certainly why I had such an amazing experience. But to me, it was like other women need to know this. We talk about pregnancy and all its nuances, but labor is not where if there's going to be any trauma, that's where it's going to happen. And then we have postpartum depression. And where can that come out? Well, your experience of your rights ripped away from you in that moment. And be it you want something, but it's not going to happen. You don't want an episiotomy and it happens. Be it a vacuum and you didn't want that for your baby. But you're in a very vulnerable, most vulnerable situation. And your partner doesn't know what to say or stand up for or can't question because it's life or death, perhaps, or it's not, but you don't know that because no one's told you if this happens, we'll go this way. If this happens, we'll go that way. But I don't know what to ask because I have no idea if you're a first-time parent. So with vaccines, it was similar. Is yes, this is a vaccine, as an antigen. Its point is to make antibodies. End of story? Or is there more to it? And it wasn't me that decided that this was an area that I want to go down to. It was very inquisitive mothers that to me, my baby was just born and I had started practicing in Singapore. They came to me to ask me questions and or for me to answer why their child had had a certain type of reaction to a vaccine. They had seen specialists in Singapore. Singapore is super easy to see specialists very quickly. And they had already seen them. I was their last resort. I knew nothing at that point. I didn't know what I was dealing with. Right? Like, how could a vaccine even be part of this conversation? I have no idea, but I was absolutely not going to say to them, you know, this is crazy for you to think. I was a new mom and I'm like, you are here to pay me to tell you what's going on. And I actually have no idea. I felt incredibly embarrassed, actually. And that's where I'm like, okay, well, there's got to be an answer. And so 10 years later, I have questions that aren't answered, but through COVID, there's more and more researchers that are answering my question to things that no one could answer before or cared to. They're just like, I don't know. It's an odd phenomenon, Taylor. So with vaccine informed consent, I think it's an area that is incredibly missing within medicine. That's going to be because you don't have to. And to me, there's 7 steps to achieve informed consent that's specifically laid out by the BC CDC. And when you do training to administer vaccines, which I have done, and I can administer vaccines in my office, I took the training, which nurses take. It's 7 steps to achieve informed consent. And one of those steps is questions and answers from your patients. So to me is, okay, well, whatever your question is, I need to be able to answer that. And there's no
safe space for that.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And what I have seen now, I've been back in Canada now for 9 years, is from Singapore, is the people that come in to see me have seen a healthcare provider around vaccines. But what happened is that they gaslit, shamed their patient when they were asking questions. And so then they never went back. The vaccine hesitancy movement, to me, largest reason is how your healthcare provider treats you. Mm-hmm. And I see those people in my office over and over and over again because their pediatrician might say something like, if you don't vaccinate your child, they will die, end quote, which is not at all true. Just because you don't get a vaccine equals death. No. So to them is be it your new parents freaked out by this, or you're, you know, it's your child number 4. You want to go in and you're in a sort of a different space if you've already been a parent and you're just like, you don't talk to me like that. But then of course you're scared because you don't want to lose a pediatrician. So you skirt around it and or never bring it up, fear to ask because, you know, they might drop you as a patient, which does happen, particularly in the States. They will drop you if you don't do all the vaccines or follow the protocol. There are reasons for that. I don't know about Canada so much, but they could. And if you want to report that pediatrician to the college most likely would do nothing about that because the pediatrician is standing for to get vaccinated or else. And to the college, that wouldn't be, you know, manipulation or
they'd be like, oh, that's viable.
That's plausible.
Sure. You could fire them and get rid of the sense of belonging and safety. Like, we don't care because we want the behavior to be different.
Right. And so I vowed to myself that I would never use manipulation or fear as a tactic to get a patient to do something. And I tell a lot of my patients, I say to them, I actually don't care what you do. I don't. What I care about is that you are fully informed when you make a decision. That's all I care about. I have tons of patients that vaccinate. They just want to talk and have someone listen without, you know, interrupting them or being disrespectful. It's just like, look, I just want to talk. Can you just tell me X, Y, Z, something very simple? I get a lot of questions that are really simple questions, but they just want to talk to a human about it. They don't want to go on Google anymore. Just say to my face, you know, what is this? What is that? Can you separate the MMR vaccine? What is chickenpox? You know, these questions that you'll find them anywhere, but that human connection is what they're wanting. Someone to be behind them about their decision-making and support them through it. And if there are any adverse reactions, I'm there to support them. I haven't had one adverse reaction that I've needed to report in my office. And I've administered vaccines. I've had no adverse reactions I'd need to report. And be it, it's how we're doing it, the structure around that. And we do things pre and post with a vaccine. Some people want it or have to, and I am there for anyone, be it they want to or have to. I've had patients full ride scholarship to New York and have to be vaccinated in order to attend the university. So they choose me to do it. And we go ahead and, you know, do one at a time for those because we're not going to do all of them at once. Unvaccinated 18-year-old. So these are the decision making that, you know, it can be your unique situation. And there is more than one way to do it. Or it doesn't have to be, I wouldn't suggest if you've never been vaccinated, you know, a 6-year-old to go in, which I've had a children do in terms of within a divorces, a parent taking a child to now get them vaccinated for all of them, including COVID and flu with other vaccines, which there is no evidence to show safety with COVID and flu and all the other vaccines all at once. But what's happened is Dr. Paul Offit, people might know that name. He's a pediatrician, vaccinologist in the United States. He once said, maybe multiple times, that hypothetically, children can receive 100 vaccines at once.
Oh my God.
Which was a question on my exam. And you have to get 100% in order to pass. True or false? Can children receive safely 100 vaccines at once?
That's not true. That's so, just an opinion.
There's an opinion, not evidence-based. But with that is the feeling, well, if he said that, we could do them all at once because it would be 6. He said 100. So that's the training as well. I'm doing the training. Nurses are doing the training. Now you read a question like that, then you know that you could do them all. Does it? But can you? Question mark. Is there evidence to show that you could do them all at once? Vaccinations are inherently inflammatory. It's non-negotiable. They are inflammatory.
Yes.
In order to elicit an immune response, you have to create an inflammatory cascade to create T and B cell immunity. So how much inflammation can that body handle? Question mark. How well are they going into the vaccine to receive that? Is there obesity? If you are overweight and you don't take care of yourself, you are already inflamed. Add in more inflammation. It's also immunosuppressive as well if you are overweight as well. your adipose tissue is part of that, creating an inflammatory cascade. So knowing that vaccines are inflammatory, be it there are less antigens, the antigens in vaccines are less than what you would receive, be it you breathed in and someone was coughing on you, all those antigens coming from that person, the vaccine does have a lot less. Okay. The people thought, okay, well, it's the antigen number that's the problem. It's not the antigen number that's the problem. It is the stimulation of the immune response to create memory that inflammation on some bodies are going to be okay and some bodies are not.
Right.
Epigenetically will be part of that. Your epigenetics, be it you are a more pro-inflamed person, if your body can't turn off that inflammation, you're a person that is in a mild car accident, takes forever to recover. You're the person that does surgery and doesn't recover because all these things are really inflammatory and you just don't have the anti-inflammatory components to help you, or you're going into it really inflamed as well. But your epigenetics can be part of the problem, meaning they just don't shut off inflammation. You roll your ankle and it's inflamed for weeks. You're like, I don't get what's up. So same thing with vaccinations. They are inflammatory. So that piece of information too is, well, be it you could receive 6, but should you receive 6? Is that the appropriate way? And to public health is like, well, but that means you have to make 6 different appointments. You should just do it all at once. Or if you're trying to separate them, then you're going to have more pokes. Should you do that? Yeah, it's part of the conversation, but does it really matter that I have to drive here 6 times? Does it really matter? That's up to me. I'll deal with that.
Reducing the risk and
don't need to convince me that I should just come once versus 6 times if it means it's better for the human body and the immune system to do them separately. Be it that's a conversation. And no, I would not recommend doing all the vaccines and COVID and flu. It's not on a schedule. It hasn't been, and I mean MMR, 6-in-1, you know, PCV13, all of them, that hasn't been deemed safe yet. But when people are doing catch-up schedules, then they will do that. And I don't. And I've had parents in a legal battle and I've suggested not to because that is not evidence-based. There's nothing that I can. And so that is part of the informed consent component. And as a practitioner to share, you know, that type of information that you know, they're not going to know that. And you can withhold that information. Or maybe you yourself don't even know. Maybe you don't know. So you're not going to share it. And so I think if you're going to be in the arena of vaccines, particularly, then I think you should have a little bit of more education around it. And because parents are inquisitive, your parents are lawyers, your parents are, you know, vet techs, your parents are, who cares with, maybe they don't, never been to college before. There is age of information. A person can read. And so they're going to come with questions that you should have the capacity and ability to answer. If you don't, then you should do some learning. Lots of stuff out now. Still stuff we don't know. And or if there isn't the information out there, then you have the duty to your patient to let them know that it doesn't exist. And I will say, I don't know. I'm comfortable saying I don't know something. I think a lot of practitioners are uncomfortable saying they don't know something as though they always have to know the answer. It's okay to not know the answer.
Well, no, there's never been a study run where a child receives all of the, even the scheduled ones at once, you know? Right. So the reason that they chose that you weren't considered vaccinated till 14 days after your second shot is because within 14 days, infections went up and so did adverse reactions. So you're instantly counted in the unvaccinated group for infections. And also the adverse reaction you might have is counted in the unvaccinated people if you get hospitalized or something happens. And so you're more likely to catch COVID within those 14 days because of the impact on the immune system. But that was widely known about the flu shot. And it's also widely known that it would change the numbers significantly. Like if they actually explained that to everybody and actually showed who was within their 14-day window. I remember Alberta by accident had that data available online. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole blog post written about it. And then it got taken down because you could see that it was actually when you included those numbers, they were all in the unvaccinated group and giving this misrepresentation. And then over time, more people were hospitalized who had received the vaccine per 100,000. So an appropriate comparison of a denominator. And I still was like, man, people are not. That's when you know that it becomes a religion, which I think is very much what has happened with any form of commitment to vaccine-informed consent, but also data. Like, I look at the MAHA movement that happened in the U.S., and now, as we record this, Robert Kennedy Jr. is now the head of HHS.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I can understand why people don't like Trump. I can understand why people don't like aspects of Robert Kennedy. Sure. But what I cannot understand is when someone says, we're not taking vaccines away. We just want to ensure that the data is actually rigorous if we're going to inject them in people. How is that a partisan issue? And if we get defensive about it, it reminds me a lot of the subject of circumcision, that a lot of the people who are most opposed to circumcision, or sorry, most for it, are men who've received it, because they can't handle the dissonance that perhaps they were harmed. So they share this propagandized information like, oh, it reduces STI. It's better for, you know, cleanliness. These are all lies and misrepresented data that, of course, was no one goes through. And of course, that's it. I mean, that's informed consent on even the subject of circumcision, which is genital mutilation and fractures the attachment with the mother in the first 8 days of life.
You know, it's interesting. When we lived in Singapore, we lived in Dubai before that. And so we had friends from, made friends from all over the world because we have a lot of expats that moved to Dubai. And I was pregnant when I was in Dubai. So I had conversations with my girlfriends and from the UK, from Ireland. And they said, did you know that we don't, it's not common to do circumcision?
Yeah.
I was like, what? No. They're like, I don't know anyone that's actually been circumcised. I've actually never, you know, these are 30-year-old women. Like, I've never been to, they say to me, is they've never been with a man that had been circumcised. I'm like, what? Really?
So strange.
So it's just so interesting that North America is basically like the, we're used to the place that that is normal, regular to do circumcision. And then we've got large parts of the world that never do. And I didn't know that until being over there and talking to them. And, you know, and I, here's like five women standing in front of me and we're talking about it. And they're like, no, never been, don't know, never met a man, you know? And so they're like, no, that's not what we do. We don't do that. And anyway, so I thought that was, you know, sparked my interest as well around that subject. Just, interesting. So you've got millions of people that don't, but we do it for, you know, cleanliness or adverse reactions of not, but they're not. So why do we push it? Why are we pushing it? I know in British Columbia that it's, I believe it's a $300 cost to have it done. So more are opting out because of the cost, not because of any other reason. Yeah, the informed consent around that.
It's like religion masquerading as medicine. There's a great documentary called it's called American Circumcision. It's done by a guy named Brendan Murata. And he talks about how whatever the reason is for circumcision always follows the most scary health thing at the time. So like AIDS is the most recent one, that it reduces transmission of STIs and AIDS. But he goes through actually the studies and walks through how like the education and the ways that participants were paid. Like it's just, it's so many violations again of informed consent and violations of medical ethics. But then, you know, it's the thing that makes it into the literature that then supports what, you know, I mean, physicians make a lot of money from circumcision in the U.S. Right. So it makes sense. And if a physician has been circumcised, they're more likely to be pro that because they can't deal with it.
Yep.
Yeah. It's wild because that skin is the clitoral hood, you know, and we would never take the clitoral hood off a female. That would cause so much drama. I was reading a thread, a conversation about it where people were in the comments conversating about it. And a mother said, Oh yeah, she knew of someone who got it at 18 because they got made so much fun of at school, and so she circumcised her son so that he didn't get made fun of. And I'm like,
oh boy,
this is the level of, I mean, first off, we should have rules for who has children, because like, when we're starting to make decisions based on not hurting people's feelings, it's really
not even being 18 and healing from that and being
it's really sad. And it just shows you the level of misinformation, which is always pointed the other way. Mm-hmm. That the misinformation is the vaccine injury. The misinformation is the conversation about shingles and later life for the chicken pox. You know, the misinformation is saying that it doesn't have long-term data, or it doesn't stop transmission, or won't create herd immunity. That was all labeled misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and having a conversation about vaccines doesn't make you anti anything. I've had colleagues tell me, well, Taylor, because you are allowing the conversation, you're going to create hesitancy.
That's healthy hesitancy, though.
If a patient has a question and I come back at them saying, well, that's a stupid question, I'm not sure how well that's going to go, and how that doesn't foster even more hesitancy, because it's like I'm withholding something or I'm just turning it on them. It's just these antics, particularly in this subject, that just...
This subject has a religion. It's a religion.
Right, right. That's why I'm so interested in the subject, because I have so far removed myself from that part where I just want you to have the information. And I'm not part of the hesitancy. If not, those that won't allow you to have a conversation actually are part of the hesitancy. But the psychology that comes with it is so fascinating to me too, that you can call someone out a killer if they don't do a vaccine, or, you know, you can't come over if you don't do this, or don't have your child around my child. And so it's like, where does that come from? How come an unvaccinated child can't sit beside your child? They're carrying measles, is it? They would be, A, showing symptoms. B, that's why you got vaccinated. That's why you get vaccinated.
Right.
If you're going to travel to the Philippines where there's measles, you're not getting vaccinated for measles to protect Filipinos. You're getting the measles vaccine to protect yourself is why you're getting it. That is the reason. Yes, you get it to not spread and it spread to others, but the sole reason that you get it is for you. It is a singular purpose for you, not for others in actuality. I mean, you get boil it down. It's like, are you really doing it for others, or are you actually doing it for yourself? This is not something to pat your back on and say, see, I did this for you. No.
Well, that's, you did it for you. That's codependency too. And I think that's why and look, I understand the benefit of collectivist thinking, of course. But collectivist thinking at the cost of the individual is self-abandonment. And this is the exact same thing as relationship. If your relationship requires that you absolve yourself of a self, then your relationship is not healthy. And just like if your relationship is all about you, that's not healthy. So there is this dance between the individual and togetherness. And when I think about the idea that if you answer more questions and really participate in informed consent, you'll create hesitancy. But then if I follow that path psychologically, my guess is that if this patient now has hesitancy, then my fear is that they'll not get it. So I already have a bias. But the other part is that I'm afraid that other doctors and people are going to think of me as being someone who creates hesitancy. Mm-hmm. So it's really about the self. It's really about the perception of self. So it's the unwillingness, which I think this actually goes to the core pathology of what is the baseline psychology of people who go into healthcare practitioner spots, coaching, therapy, dietitians, nurses, name it, is that the underlying fear there is then, what will other people think about me? So really, I want you to not ask more questions because I'm afraid that you'll be thought of as an anti-vaxxer. But then I also have to deal with the fact that I don't ask all those questions. So if I stop your behavior, I deal with my own fears. And so at the underlying pathology that I see going into this work, which is also a reflection of myself, is that it's people who tended to take care of other people's feelings when they were young. They maybe took care of someone who had an illness. They had a narcissistic parent, alcoholic parent. They might be the oldest. They took care of their siblings. no matter what it was, they got some sort of safety, perceived safety from taking care of other people. And so they're actually the people least likely to stand in a truth and face adversity, because at the basis of their very work is the desire to take away other people's suffering. See what I'm saying? And that's why I think so much of that space, which I saw myself confronted with this when during COVID, is that there, it's really about a fear of hurting people's feelings. And so this is why I think you see this happening with gender ideology, with all of it, is the actual people who are supposed to be ensuring that we're connected to some form of reality and truth are actually the least likely to hold it for fear of causing emotional disruption. I think it rings true.
I just love the way you think and what you have to say, because it just, it creates pause. And for me, it creates pause of just like, sit with that. Because I am always searching for why. Why is vaccine scope so emotionally charged? I realize that getting vaccinated means you can protect other people. I realize that. That's sort of the part of creating herd immunity.
Right.
If you
the,
can even
the
do
virus
that.
Ends with you, blah, blah. Right. Yeah.
But there's just so much more to
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Once you so got it, more. It don't end with you.
No.
You got vaccinated.
It doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. Thing it start, is
now
that.
Now you're a vector.
Yes.
And so you're saying, oh, I'm going to get it so I'm not a vector. And, you know, it shames people too when they get sick.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I've even through COVID is just do not be ashamed when you get sick. Right. It's okay that you're sick.
Like, what's people, wrong with me that I got it? I'm vaccinated.
Right. And it could be it something be of other it, million other reasons of what you just contracted, by the way.
Right. Right. Which too. We're using, I mean, don't even get me started on the PCR test. And it's
yes.
oh, like the level of deception if people mm-hmm. really understood.
And that was part of even the beginning for me of how in the world are we getting so many positive COVIDs? Influenza just disappeared. So many positive right. COVID, specifically SARS-CoV-2. Could it not be one of the other strains as well? We've always known there's five main strains that cause the common cold of the coronavirus, Coronaviridae family. We've known that. And so then you got SARS-CoV-2, new kid on the block. How in the world is it only that one? It could be the other ones. And this is where your right. testing is. Right. I full-handedly believe was failing us in terms of statistics. So that's completely...
PCR death was a total farce, especially because most of the labs in Canada were running cycle thresholds well over 35, 40, which is, as Anthony Fauci said, anything over 35 is just picking up dead nucleotide, which is right. why people were asymptomatic and right. showing positive, but actually had passed, it had come through them and they had T-cell mm-hmm. memory from their other coronaviruses they experience. I mean, this, mm-hmm. I'm not an immunologist. Why do I know this?
Because you can read. You know what?
Well, I had to learn.
Don't have to have.
I was like, I feel like I'm fucking crazy.
You don't have to be, you don't have to do training in this area actually to understand it either. Epidemiology is one of, unfortunately, one of the poorest areas of research. I mean, you can't at any one moment know exactly what infection is around you. Really, as a perspective of a naturopathic doctor, when it comes to immunity and infections, you need to make you yourself, number one, accountable by way of making sure that you are not susceptible. To me, that mm-hmm. is number one hardcore ground that we need to be working on first. Mm-hmm. Your tool is not even good. Your vaccine is not going to work in a body that cannot make immunity. You can't make antibodies very well. TMB cell, forget it. But you're not told that. You're not told that the donut that you just got after that COVID vaccine will inhibit you from making immunity. Sugar is the problem in terms of it is immunosuppressant too. Yes, you're immunocompromised. If you eat that way, you are overweight, you don't exercise, you drink alcohol, you don't sleep.
Insulin resistance, baseline.
Da, 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 da. You yeah. are immunocompromised. Yeah. And a lot of those things, unfortunately, are on you. You need to take accountability for yourself. So if you're not going to test your vitamin D status, I get that it can be expensive, then take it upon yourself and purchase a $10 bottle of vitamin D and start there and start reducing the pop that you're drinking and et cetera. And make your body less susceptible to the infection, which will increase less spreading as well. And so because it perhaps can end with you, because now you're and you stayed home and you work through it real quick, and now you created immunity. So now you have immunity to it. Because you took care of yourself, you reduced your symptomology too, because you took care of yourself and helped yourself while you had the infection as well. There are great things out there on the market that can help you through an infection. Don't underestimate the power of oil, oregano, berberine, high dose vitamin C, zinc, selenium, vitamin A, which is one of my most favorite vitamins, is vitamin A, because that's also been ostracized as vitamin A, that it's deadly and scary and no one should take vitamin A. Why you can't find it on the shelf. Beta carotene, go to town on beta carotene. But if you can't convert beta carotene to vitamin A, which is incredibly important, vitamin A itself is used to help with crosstalk between white blood cells. So a white blood cell has a virus, it will shoot out information to surrounding white blood cells that has a virus in it so that they can get ready to kill the virus. The only way to kill a virus is your own immune system. Your innate immune system kills it. Phagocytosis, it eats it, and then it self-implodes. It denatures that virus. But it has to be able to do that. And it also has to be ready to know that it needs to do that. Mm-hmm. And so vitamin A is part of the crosstalk. But we don't, no one takes enough. A lot of people are probably short on vitamin A. Cod liver oil, your grandparents would take a table of cod liver oil to start their day. It's awesome vitamin A in it. And so vitamin A is one of the leading causes of why measles infection does poorly in developing countries. So they give, WHO gives vitamin A along with the MMR vaccine.
Oh, interesting.
Because of its potency to help. So we're like, oh, there's no way I'm vitamin A deficient. Well, if you just had a virus, it will wipe your vitamin A too. So increase it. So if I'm sick, my kids are sick, they're getting drops of vitamin A, which is amazing for eyesight, your mucous membranes. It's preventative to help decrease your night vision. So those that you start driving at night and it's like, I can't, that's vitamin A deficiency. It's already happening. So let's prevent it. It's part of it. So those are, I would say, main, you know, your echinacea, your elderberry go a long way. Having those things in your cupboard at the first sign of an infection, take those. Don't just douse yourself with Tylenol and NyQuil.
Right. I like basically mainline vitamin C too, liposomal, you know. Mm-hmm. Vitamin D, though, I realize like how important it is to take, you know, where I've lived, where there's clouds and it's, I mean, we're in the Northern Hemisphere, so we need more. So I'm taking, you know, 5,000 a day, just like with K2, right? You're supposed to take it with
K2? That's for bone density and support is K2. But what's interesting about vitamin D and deficiency, living in Dubai, most people are vitamin D deficient. Living in Singapore, most people are vitamin D deficient. And that's because they cover themselves up. Right, so in Singapore,
Their skin.
Well, everyone has an umbrella to protect and it is more sought after to have more white skin.
That's right.
Skin.
Cultural. I see that in Vancouver when I lived there. A lot of, I was imagining Chinese people would cover themselves with like gloves and hats and umbrellas so they don't get tans. I didn't realize that until my friend who's Chinese was like, yeah, it's due to, you know, he explained the cultural background to it.
And if you live, you know, if you have darker skin, because you live closer to the equator, that's why you have darker skin, that will act as a sunblock. So then you yourself need to take more vitamin D. So basically everyone.
Yeah. Also, we need to have our skin and our eyes exposed.
Yes.
At least 15 minutes. A lot about that.
Yeah. No sunglasses, at least 15
Contact
minutes.
Contact lenses are bad too.
Probably. Yeah. Contact lenses would be.
I was wearing them and my friend who's buddies with Jack Cruz was like, get your contact lenses out. And I'm like, damn, I use them for sports and stuff. But I did notice what you're saying about vision is interesting. Like I was reading about how red light therapy can really help with preventing the decline of vision, like nearsightedness as you get older. Mm. Or sorry, the inability to, like you need reading glasses.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's really fascinating. Like to think about supplementing from a perspective of vitamin A. I've not thought about that for vision.
Yeah. Vitamin A. I love
that vitamin. What do you do in a drop?
Yeah. So you can get it suspended in oil. Like MCT oil is what I use. You can get them in gel caps, but I use it in dropper because then I can control the drops too. Cause I will do high dose. I do high dose when my patients are doing the MMR vaccine. We do high dose vitamin A with the MMR, and 2 weeks later, my patients are sick, or kiddos, because I work with children, complex pediatric cases. So pandas, pans, if they're having a flare, we'll do high dose vitamin A as well within that flare too. It's a vitamin that just is, has profound work. So get your vitamin A. Cod liver oil is going to be tough to get to the dosage that we're wanting to reach.
Get enough bio of it.
Yeah. You're going to have to chug the bottle, which I wouldn't recommend.
Your breath. Yeah. At least stay away from your partner for a while. I'm curious, what is your advice in terms of best sort of supplement regimen especially in flu season?
So get your vitamin D up. And that might range from 5,000 to even 10,000. And you can get it tested. I do vitamin D injections for patients. We'll do it 100,000 in terms of injections. Your vitamin A, there are companies that will make what's called ACEs plus zinc. So ACE, selenium, and zinc all in one. Zinc is a big one.
It's really good for immune function.
Yes. Yeah. So zinc in terms of immunity has an antiviral effect to it. And that's why it was big within COVID, because it has a direct, in terms of when it comes to antivirals, what antivirals mean is slowing down replication of the virus. That's what it means. You don't kill a virus with any type of medication, drug, herb, supplement. You work to slow its replication down is what you do. You can kill a bacteria with things, but you can't viruses. So that's how you skirt around, is you need to slow its replication so your immune system can seek and destroy. So you need your immune system to be able to do that. So zinc, I mean, some people just, zinc is hard to get in food. Oysters is one of your main places, which not a lot of people eat. So we need to supplement with it. And sometimes we're going from 15 milligrams up to 60 milligrams per day of zinc, depending. It can make you feel nauseated. So you always take it with food. Always, 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 always. Glutathione is another one. Glutathione, which I also do pre-post vaccines, works to help with phagocytosis. So in terms of your innate cells, your glutathione supports phagocytosis. It's a gentle chelator, so it can also bind to the aluminum that's in vaccines, and helps with oxidative damage too. So glutathione is also used just generally as anti-aging, supporting liver detoxification, helps with phase two. Glutathione is a...
What delivery mechanism?
Yeah, liposomal, which is tough to get into kids because it's a sulfur product. So it's kind of like rotten eggs. It's a little bit nasty. So you could do the building blocks of glutathione, which may not be as good. So NAC and glycine, glutamate, are the three amino acids that make glutathione. So there can get NAC, NAC, and acetylcysteine, which people did also through COVID. Is a little bit easier to take. You could open the capsule and take it. It's not as disgusting. But NAC and glycine you could take together. NAC is just great as a mucolytic. It helps break up, you know, mucus in your lungs if you have a chesty cough. So through cold and flu season, if you have a chesty cough, then you would take NAC to help with that, break that up. And then if we can, we take NAC with glutathione to help with the chesty cough, glutathione to help with the immune system. You take them together because NAC will help keep glutathione in its form of glutathione, because otherwise it'll break into those three amino acids. In terms of herbs, I mean, if you can swallow pills, or kiddos can swallow pills, I love oil of oregano, but emulsified oil of oregano. And there's one company that does it in a tablet form, so if they can swallow the tablet, that one is a game changer. If you oil of oregano, you could take and you can gargle if you think you have strep throat coming on, you could gargle it.
Oh, wow.
Spit it out or swallow it. But what I like about the emulsified form is it goes all the way to the gut. So you can deal with gut problems, but then it'll go systemic and it's a lot more palatable. Berberine is another one, is a great antimicrobial as well. And then elderberry goes a long way with kids. Elderberry does.
And, yeah, because it's like a little syrup.
Yeah, it's syrup and it's antiviral. It's yummy. Kids will do it. So having that in your cupboard, an organic Ciro. Ciro is a company that's really nice, made in Canada. So
what about berberine for blood glucose? People use it.
And a lower dose, so it's around the 500 milligram mark daily. But if you're wanting to go more infectious related, then you go like a gram twice, if not a gram three times a day. You go higher dose for not very long, because berberine potentially can hurt your own good gut microbiome. So we don't want to take high dosages for long periods of time. Even for the glucose bit, I don't like people taking it every single day. You know, pulse dose it, take a break, take a break. Obviously, you're changing your diet and you're exercising. But in the meantime, you know, you're taking it to help with your blood sugar. I'd rather that than if we can stay away from things like, like metformin, for sure. Yeah,
just like apple cider vinegar, which I was so surprised if you drink a bit of glucose, it prevents glucose spikes.
Oh, interesting. I mean, awesome, helping with digestion.
It tastes good as long as you're drinking the organic stuff, because it's not as the acidity and quality of, you know, the stuff that you buy off the shelf.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think these are having some key nutraceuticals in your house that you take regularly, I think saves you money. And people are like, how? Well, because you're not going to miss work.
Money, all of it. It's like, it's so worth it.
It really is. And I mean, to me, I mean, I don't have time to get sick. So I will do all those things.
Same.
I recommend IV therapy as well. If you can get in, do IV therapy.
You smell like a vitamin after, but you feel so good.
I'll taste it. I don't like that.
I do too. I was thinking, I was like, man, I wonder if two single people, after they get vitamins, they're like, their pheromones are like, they're like, damn, you smell good. Yeah. You're all dosed up. I actually have to find a place in Calgary to do IVs.
Oh, there's lots. There's lots so there. Good. Yeah.
How you feel?
Oh, yeah. If I can do it once a week, you know, during the season, I will. It's usually once a month. And then I have a foot bath and then have a sauna session.
Sort of my rotation of things.
Yeah.
Dr. Taylor Bean, I could talk to you all day. We'll definitely have to do this again. I'm curious for everyone listening, where can they find more of you?
Yeah, Instagram. So Dr. Taylor Bean on Instagram and my website, drtaylorbean.com. The clinic is tailormadewellness.com, so you'll find us there. Those interested to learn a little bit more around vaccines, I do have the vaccineoptimization.com website. On there, I offer also a program, Vaccine Savvy Program for parents, which is we do three sessions. It includes your webinars, and then I send a little vitamin package of things that you can't get off the shelf, either to support you pre-post or if you decide not to vaccinate, some key items to have in your house. And I'm in the works of making a journal to go alongside the webinars, because I've had a lot of people, it's a lot of content. And while you're writing notes as you're going along, it's just sort of, they're all over the place. And so I'm in the works to make a journal that you can follow along and remember some key components. So then when we have a conversation, it's like, right, this is what I was thinking when I was listening to it, which is then to morph into a book is what's going to happen. Amazing. And so I have a microbiologist who does a lot of vaccine education. She's an immunologist, not a microbiologist, an immunologist who does a lot of lectures around vaccines, who will be part of it or will go through the book with me. Because infant immunity, I find, is an area in terms of any vaccine book that you find doesn't go heavy enough into it and understanding that. Because I think it's really important. That's where the bulk of vaccines take place, is in infancy. So I think we do need to have a conversation, an in-depth conversation around how their immunity works and so forth. So yeah.
Beautiful. Awesome. Well, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. It was awesome. I learned some things and I love your perspective. I appreciate it.
Ditto. I'm curious, where are you stuck in love? In your relationships, in your life, and even just in your life, right? Because, you know, maybe you're constantly attracting the wrong partners, unavailable people, or you're healing from heartbreak and you don't know how to move forward. Maybe you're in a relationship, but it's plateaued and you're wondering, is this it? And how do I move beyond this? Whatever your situation is, I created something to help you get clarity fast. It's a free quiz called Where Are You Stuck in Love? This quiz will show you whether your next step is working on self-love, healing your past, learning to date with intention, or deepening your current relationship. The truth is, we can't change what we don't see. This quiz helps you pinpoint exactly what is keeping you from the love you want and gives you clear, guided advice on what to do next. Over 2,000 people have already taken it and had a major aha moment. You're next. Go to createthelove.com/quiz right now. That's createthelove.com/quiz, and let's get you unstuck.